Kadosh. Remember, remember, Adonai Eloheinu.
Welcome to Romamu, an open-hearted Jewish community and house of worship, learning, and spiritual growth. You're listening to Romamu's podcast, where we share words of Torah, insights, and inspiration from Romamu clergy. Thank you for being with us.
I think it's impossible to fully express how many miles away we are from the state of Israel. It's impossible to fully quantify or even qualify the difference between reading about something that's happening over there and something that is happening within that space. Whatever we saw in the news, whatever it was that we tried to to connect with, we are a million miles away. For the minute I landed in Ben Gurion, as I said last night, I walked into an Israel that I'd never been in before. And I've been to Israel many, many times. There was a palpable sense from the moment I got off the plane that in a land where they package the surreal as part of their national export, the exporting of the surreal, of the that which collides. The edges of Israel are remarkable. There are so many edges, and they knock into each other all the time in a dance of both conflict and wrestling, embracing and fighting. In a land that has made that synonymous, the surreal, a place where milk and honey flow together with high tech and with occupation, with the remarkable resilience of everyday living amidst possible extermination at any given moment. I met an Israel that I'd never experienced before, where the surreal was now on overdrive. Everywhere we looked, there were abandoned baby carriages. Everywhere we looked, there were images of chatufim, of hostages. Everywhere they looked, it felt like there were held back tears around each and every object and person in the land of Israel. Almost a thinly veiled, raw wound that is still ongoing. And also, nothing of the 9 months that preceded it. Nothing of the infighting and the finger pointing, nothing of you're on this team and I'm on that team, nothing. Nothing. There was an almost eerily polite nature going on. No, you go first. No, you go first. I thought to myself, am I in Israel? And almost a remarkable religious or spiritual kind of almost like mana that has come down from somewhere. I was sitting on the plane on the way there next to a woman and her three children. I was wondering where her husband was, but I kept thinking her husband must be in Milwim in reserves, and she took the kids on some kind of holiday to get away from it all. I found out later on that her husband had passed away, but not from the war, and she was alone as a single parent, reminding myself, of course, that not every tragedy that's going on in the world is related. There are other tragedies. And I was sitting with her and her sweet little boy, whose name was Tal, like mine. And as we're about to take off, this completely secular-looking family, completely chiloni-looking family, she turned to them and said, Azman Ashav le Tfilat HaDerech, let's say the prayer for traveling together. I asked her, I said, did you used to make the prayer for traveling before? She said, no. The sense in Israel that, like, almost a palpable religiosity that is not connected to any denomination, not connected to any ideology, a sense of vulnerability, a sense of radical, radical vulnerability. And another thing, that just being there, is that no matter how much we talk about processing and people can process and that leads to something, we talk about speaking stories, there's a sense that no matter how much they process, they can't process enough. And my sense too from them is that it's still not over. It's not over. And if ever the surreal nature of this living in this small piece of territory could come home to me, it was, and I said this last night a little bit, but I'll say a bit more this morning because I can't stop thinking about it, which is that I woke up in Tel Aviv on Thursday morning. I went to sleep in Tel Aviv on Wednesday night, woke up in Tel Aviv on Thursday morning, and I made my way to the train station, and I traveled into Jerusalem on Thursday morning to be back with my group. I'd stayed the night and went to see my family who live in Tel Aviv. And I came out of the out of the train station and found out that there had just been a pigua, there had just been a terrorist attack. And I was very close to it. I just come in. And I could hear the sirens blaring. And I remember thinking to myself, sounds like what it sounds like when there's a terrorist attack here. But the truce is gone. It was still the truce was happening. So I thought to myself, nah, that can't be a terrorist attack. It must just be ambulances. You know, that happens. And I got into a cab, and he said to me, it's good that you're in the cab because there are no buses. I said, what do you mean there are no buses? He said, didn't you hear? There's no buses. There was a terrorist attack. So imagine being in New York City and going on with the rest of your day in New York City. Imagine like how it is to live in Israel where you have to compartmentalize. I'm sitting less than an hour later at a lovely little restaurant in the German colony with a friend of mine ordering food from a waitress who's being pulled, like all of the amenities of living in the world. Like I had a check, I ordered food, there was a chef back there, like life went on. And three human beings who woke up that morning thinking, oh, I'm just going to work. One of them, a newlywed young woman who had just been married. And the other one of the three that were murdered was an innocent, like he was trying to help and was shot by friendly fire. He was mistaken for a terrorist. I struggled so much because to be in Eretz Yisrael, it felt to me that the Israel that I was in is an Israel that is almost never portrayed here in the United States, or when it is, it's given very quick, a kind of a quick gloss over. The Israel of democracy, even with all of its flaws and all of its warts, the Israel where on Tuesday morning we sat at the Hartman Institute with a Palestinian Israeli scholar who was on staff at Mahon Hartman, who incredibly charismatic, brilliant woman, who told us about her experience as a Palestinian Israeli and what it was like for her to live in two narratives day in and day out. But thinking to myself how far a cry it is from the caricature of an Israel, right, as an apartheid state, sitting there with her, regaling about Mansour Abbas, the most amazing, amazing Gandhi of Israel, who at risk of his own life, who is also a Muslim, and also speaks for the majority, I think, of peace-loving Muslims and trying to live within a world where there are fundamentalists and extremists and who puts his life at risk each and every day to live in Israel where that conversation is happening with all of its flaws. And yet at the same time to see a girl who's maybe a couple of months older than one of my nieces was just a few years ago, standing on a platform with a gun, of course, on her back, and thinking to myself, how tragic and at the same time, how remarkable. Thank God we have power. Thank God we have power. With all that that entails, with all of the complexities, thank God. We sat with Micha Hartman, Micha Goodman on Monday night for 3 hours, Tuesday night for 3 hours. And Micha said to us something profound. He said, here's what's happening here in the state of Israel right now. Here in the state of Israel, we are going through two potential scenarios that are lying before us. Micha said, I'm going to give you the good news and then I'll give you the bad news. The good scenario and the bad scenario. He said, what happened on October 7th, he said, was a knock on the door of the Jewish present from the Jewish past. A dash me'avar. It was like the Jewish past came and said hello to us in the present moment. He said, when Bialik wrote his famous poem, The City, right, of Slaughter, in response to the Kishinev pogrom that killed 49 people, in Be'eri alone, in Kibbutz Be'eri alone, more than that were murdered. More than the entire pogrom of Kishinev. And in that poem, he said it was the first time in Jewish history where after a pogrom, a piyut, a sacred poem was written that didn't lift up the martyrs or lift up those who were the victims, but instead blamed them. So it was the first time in Jewish history, every pogrom of the many pogroms that had led until Kishinev, whenever there was a pogrom, someone would come along and write a piyut, a sacred poem, and in it they would lift up the kiddushim, the holy ones who were the victims of that pogrom. But in Bialik's poem, he said, For the first time, the Alec says to them, how could you not defend yourselves? How could we not become people who had power? And Jabotinsky, when he translated the poem, said, that's what it's like to live, he said, in a stranger in a strange land, is to be powerless. And that the whole point of Zionism, whether you believe in it or you don't believe in it, was for Jews for once throughout history to say, we're not going to trust anyone else to make sure that our bodies will be safe. We will be safe. And what Micha said was, is that on that day, on the 7th of October, there's a radical, absolute failure of that vision in a way that had never been seen before. Yom Kippur was nothing compared. The Yom Kippur War was nothing like what happened on the 7th of October. That vision of a world where Jews would be safe from the kinds of things that happened to them throughout their exile would be a relic of history, came back for a 24-hour period. And what Micha said was that what we saw in response to it is this. Jewish people, he said, Israel awakened at that moment to an experience of a world without the state of Israel. What it would be like if there was no army? What it would be like if there were no walls? What it would be like and what it had been like for over 2,000 years? And the majority of Israel, not everybody, but the majority of Israel believes now that that is the case. That if we don't protect ourselves, this is what waits for us, period, at this moment. And in response, he said, Israelis saw that they had to take, again, reality into their own hands. And what that meant, he said, is two things. One, that they didn't wait even for the army and for the lack of trust in institutions reemerged in Israel. Startup nation became, again, grassroots nation. And all of the engines that were part of civil society that were in focus in one direction now, one of the most famous organizations in Israel who was very much involved in the protest movement preceding the war and the judicial reforms, turned on a dime and became the social sector's most powerful engine right now, the last 2 months. For all the things that the bureaucratic and top-down Israel government couldn't do, were now taken up by average people who now instituted across Israel a platform for engagement, for volunteering, for delivering services. The government turned to them to get things done. Micha said, you see, Israelis said, Israel doesn't belong to the government. The government brought us here to the brink. We have to bring ourselves back together. And there's a grassroots movement now that is spreading where Israelis are saying, it's us. We have to build the country we want to see in the world. From the right, from the left, the center of Israel is growing exponentially now. And the extremes are getting smaller and smaller. And you see in poll after poll, he said, the center, the sane center of Israel is growing and growing and growing. And so on the one hand, he said, the response has been a grassroots initiative. And the second thing he said was that there was an earthquake, a conceptual intellectual earthquake that took place. A humility now has fallen across the country where people who thought they knew something are now admitting they don't. There is now an interrogation of all of the assumptions that Israelis feel they think they knew about the world and about the world around them and the world within them, that Micha said is a remarkable moment. It's as if the entire possible future is now soft with possibilities for what might yet be formed. And in that vision, he said, it's possible for us to imagine a new Israel after all of this is done, that will begin to make changes that have long been coming from a bigger consensus, a broader consensus. He said, people who were 9 months ago fighting with one another are now fighting side by side with one another. People who thought there was no way that the elites in Tel Aviv would ever hear the herald a call to come and defend with their bodies the state of Israel were wrong. And the people who said that the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, don't care at all about Israel are wrong because it's in crazy numbers. They're volunteering and defying their own rabbis to show up. People who said that Palestinian Israelis and Arabs within would rebel were wrong. They're all like study after study, united society right now. It's unbelievable, he said. Every imagined idea, it's wrong. Everything's possible now. And in his vision, if things go well, when all of this is done, there'll be a new government because everybody will want one. And there'll be a leader who's like Levi Eshkol, one of the, right, came right after Ben-Gurion, who was a person who brought people together. He didn't divide them. He brought them together. And all the things that are now on the table, that we need to have a constitution, that we have to find a way to live with the Palestinians, every imaginable thing that needs to get solved will be solved by this broad consensus of sanity. And then he told us his doomsday possibility too. And he said it also could be that this war was just the truce before the real war. The war that was building for 9 months in Israel, in our across different tribes, where people were saying to one another, your ideas will lead us to the brink. Your ideas will lead us to the brink. If we go in your direction, it'll bring Israel to a place of existential crisis. He said, imagine what it will look like in a world of Twitter, in the Twitter world universe, where instead of saying your ideas could bring us to the brink, instead it says, your ideas led us to this catastrophe. Imagine the blame game and the kind of vocalizing of long pent-up tensions of what happened on October 7th. And when Micha told us this, he was, I could see that he was very, very scared of that possibility. And so we said to Micha, how do we stop that from happening? How do we stop that second scenario from happening? And they began to talk about how important it will be for people to give up their absolute certainties about their ideologies, to be willing to make compromises, to be able to listen, to be able to find a way to getting to guess, as William Ury, right, in the Harvard Negotiation Project spoke about, a willingness to give up our self-assured stance, but to remember that all of us are flawed and we don't have all the right answers, but we have to come to it together. And that left such a, you know, I'm sitting with that. I don't know what to do with that. Trying to figure out what my role is in all this and what our role can be here as Americans, how we might also participate in the rebuilding and reclamation of the future Israel too. One of the most powerful parts of the trip, which expresses this kind of grassroots initiative, took place on Wednesday in Tel Aviv. And for those of you, if you haven't seen it, it's like, it's unbelievable, this makeshift crazy monument that's happening in what's called Hostage Square. It's an impromptu sanctuary and an art installation. It's also a prayer space and a mourning tent that popped up in the large courtyard outside of Tel Aviv Museum of Art. It walks through, and it's as if that thin veneer that I said of tears and thin veneer of moving forward, that surrealism that is everywhere when you walk into Israel, is now, it's completely exposed. Like in Hostage Square, there is not even an attempt whatsoever to like get on with life. It's people sitting on the ground crying. It's art installation pieces of babies being held in captivity. It's people who have lost loved ones are sitting there. People who have loved ones who are still hostages trying to scream and say, right? I saw two, don't forget them. We can't forget them. They're there. So Lebanese Israelis that were holding signs saying we're Arabs and we're here to say, right, no, it's impossible to walk through and not feel completely transformed by being in it. And then to come back here and to recognize how hard it is to convey all of that in spoken word, how hard it is to convey any of it, right, at any moment. And so I just want to leave with this. I know that thank you for letting me process some of this with all of you. I really appreciate it. I promise to have a much clearer message with all of it next time I speak. And I'm just feeling more and more that we have to go. We have to go there. I know that we have to go and protest and we have to stand up and we have to pray and so on, but it means so much. It meant so much to Israelis when we came. They said, what are you doing here? We said, we came to say we're with you. And they said, Bemet? Really? And they said, Kol HaKavod, how amazing are you? And then we said to them, Kol HaKavod? You're telling us Kol HaKavod? We just got off an airplane with movies and with, you know, Torah classes on pay-per-view. And you guys are all here. You're the ones whose children are are serving. You're the ones who are waiting to see if everything will be all right. You're the ones who went through 9 months of upheavals. You're the ones who are trying to go about your daily lives and not knowing if you're getting on a bus and it's going to be the last time you're on a bus. You're the ones who are trying just to, for 50 some odd years now, 75 years, trying to live and create a sort of normal country, a normal life for your families. You're the ones. And we're the ones over here in our little mini Israels. We can walk out the door and take off our kippah and like everybody, let's go to a baseball game. You're the ones who've paid such a dear price for what it was to have Jewish power after Kishinev. You're the ones who continue to pay that price. You're the ones. And what are we doing? We're just coming to say, we're here with you. We're suffering. We can't imagine what life is like for you. How you've been holding your breath each and every day. So I feel like we have to go. To get a group trip there, arranged to meet with a broad, you know, eclectic range of people representing various sectors in Israeli society, but to put our bodies on the line too and say, we're here too. We're here with you. Because if ever there was any debate and any doubt that Jewish life outside of the land of Israel is connected to Jewish life inside of the land of Israel, there is no question any longer. And anybody who thinks there is under living under some illusion and delusion that I can't even begin to fathom. I never in my life, ever walked through TSA, the security checkpoints at Kennedy Airport or at Newark Airport, and thought to myself, I wonder if this person sees me as a Jew, as an Israeli. I never thought that. Because we live in a world where, you know, I thought, oh, okay, I don't know. Literally did not, like, for a moment, I was felt safer once I landed in Israel than I did when I was here. And everybody here knows, everybody who's been at part of Roma for like 5 minutes, if you've been around for the last, maybe not 5 minutes, maybe it has to be longer than that. If you've been here for the last 10 years or more, know that I give sermons like Labels Lie. Sermons about how we judge people by the externalities and they're not the truth of who they are, and that identities, as important as they are and as vital as they are part of a much broader unity that we share. And I still believe that with all of my heart. But where I wear my yarmulke around the Upper West Side of Manhattan right now, I know that I'm taking a risk. I believe it deeply. And I wish I didn't, because it's not really a belief. It's pretty statistically consistent with what's been going on now. And my first day in Israel, I stayed late on Monday night at the Machon, at the Hartman Institute, and I was interviewed on Israeli radio, and I tried to tell them this story, but I got cut out, so I'm going to tell it to you, and maybe someone in Israel will hear this. I walked out of the Hartman Institute at it was 10 o'clock at night. I had just been, you know, flying all day and got in, went to our hotel, we went to speak, and then I was walking home. And Machon Hartman Institute is in a beautifully, it's a beautiful area of Jerusalem, and at night it's quiet, and you can kiss the stars, you can smell the moon. It's beautiful there, right? And the trees, the breeze, it's at night, it's stunning. And I walked out, and I made a turn to go by, and I was walking by myself. It's only a 5 minute walk to the hotel, and I remember I literally started taking a couple steps, and I went like this. I was about to take my yarmulke off. I wasn't, and I don't take my yarmulke off in New York, but there's like a moment. And then I stopped, and I started to cry. And I realized, I'm just a Jew here. Nobody sees my yarmulke. I can just walk. It's like not a big deal. And I know, you know, if I'm wearing a hijab, maybe it's different. Although when I asked people wearing hijabs, they said, fine for them. Not all of them, obviously. But for me as a Jew, I thought to myself, I couldn't believe it. In 2023, I'm walking in the streets of Manhattan, of New York City, and 900% more likely that someone will attack me now than it was 2 months ago. And all of a sudden I started breathing. I was like, just to be a Jew and be safe. I know that we all need a break from it. And certainly when I was there, I felt very deeply from all of the people that were there that they need a break too, and they're not getting one. Well, they had one for 4 days. And it's a lot, week in and week out. And at the same time, you know, what are we going to do? We can't in any way, shape, or form, disconnect ourselves from what's going on the ground there with our brothers and sisters. We have an obligation to feel their feelings, an obligation to support them, an obligation to say to them, we're here for you. We know what you're going through. How can we help? How can we help? How can we help? Tell us what to do. And I feel that's where we are as a community, as a Jewish community. And maybe and I'll end with this. Thank you all for listening. I think maybe the greatest thing we can do, besides giving money, and besides writing our senators and our congresspeople, is to get up and go. And so in the coming days and weeks, I'll be trying to figure out if there's a desire for that to happen in this community. I certainly am thinking about it for the 92nd Street Y community. And if this speaks to you here or online or wherever you are, it would be great to hear from you, to let us know that that's something you'd like to do, and we'll begin making arrangements to take a group. Well, obviously, when security is, obviously all of the various elements that will be in place and all the details will be something that we'll share if it happens. But you can't imagine how good it feels for you. It will feel for you and for them to see us coming together with our differences, with our, various places we're coming from. Trust me, even if there is unity in Israel now, 9 months ago, there was great disparity amongst Israelis about every imaginable thing. And we can still go to Israel, even if you don't like some things that you think they're doing. You can still show up. Maybe that itself will be one of the greatest acts of courage that we can do at this moment. May God bless our brothers and sisters. Give them strength. May God bless our community to be able to one day be able to sit together in peace. Ish tachagat, know each one under their fig tree, where plowshares have been now taking the place of swords, and handshakes have taken the place of striking one another. May a day of peace, a peace that is safe and secure, a peace that is full of dignity, a peace that is, at this moment, unimaginable. May that vision come true soon. Let us say amen.
Thank you for listening. Want more content like this? Subscribe to our podcast and visit romamu.org to learn more about us. Please consider making a contribution to Romamu so we can continue to fulfill our mission to help spiritual seekers deepen their connection to Jewish wisdom and practice to help them become more compassionate human beings. We hope to see you in the synagogue or the Zoomagogue soon. Romamu, Romamu, Adonai.